else. She's alive, she shouted. We must get her to hospital. Leave us alone and catch the man who did this. Mingora seems like a big town to us, but it's really a small place and the news quickly spread. My father was at the Swat Press Club for a meeting of the Association of Private Schools and had just gone on stage to give a speech when his mobile rang. He recognized the number as Hushal's school and passed the phone to his friend Ahmed Shah to answer. Your school bus has been fired on, he whispered urgently to my father. The color drained from my father's face. He immediately thought Malala could be on that bus. Then he tried to reassure himself, thinking it might be a boy, a jealous lover who had fired a pistol in the air to shame his beloved. The meeting he was at was an important gathering of about 400 principals who had come from all over Swat to protest against plans by the government to impose a central regulatory authority. As president of their association, my father felt he couldn't let all those people down, so he delivered his speech as planned. But there were beads of sweat on his forehead, and for once there was no need for anyone to signal to him to wind it up. As soon as he had finished, my father did not wait to take questions from the audience, and instead rushed off to the hospital with Ahmed Shah and another friend, Riaz, who had a car. The hospital was only 5 minutes away. They arrived to find crowds gathered outside and photographers and TV cameras. Then he knew for certain that I was there. My father's heart sunk. He pushed through the people and ran through the flashes from the cameras into the hospital. Inside, I was lying on a trolley, a bandage over my head. My eyes closed, my hair spread out. My daughter, you are my brave daughter, my beautiful daughter, he said over and over, kissing my forehead and cheeks and nose. He didn't know why he was speaking to me in English. I think somehow I knew he was there, even though my eyes were closed. My father said, I can't explain it. I felt, she responded. Someone said I had smiled. But to my father, it was not a smile, just a small, beautiful moment because he knew he had not lost me forever. Seeing me like that was the worst thing that had ever happened to him. All children are special to their parents, but to my father, I was his universe. I had been his comrade in arms for so long, first as Gul Makai, then quite openly as Malala. He had always believed that if the Taliban came for anyone, it would be for him, not me. He said he felt as if he had been hit by a thunderbolt. They wanted to kill two birds with one stone, he said. Kill Malala and silence me forever. He was very afraid, but he didn't cry. There were people everywhere. All the principals from the meeting had arrived at the hospital, and there were scores of media and activists. It seemed the whole town was there. Pray for Malala, he told them. The doctors reassured him they had done a CT scan which showed that the bullet had not gone near my brain. They cleaned and bandaged the wound. Oh, Ziyadeen, what had they done? Madam Miriam, my headmistress, burst through the doors. She had not been at school that day and was at home nursing her baby when she received a phone call from her brother-in-law checking she was safe. Alarmed, she switched on the TV and saw the headline that there had been a shooting on the Hushal school bus. As soon as she heard I had been shot, she called her husband. He brought her to the hospital on the back of his motorbike. Something very rare for a respectable Pashtun woman. Malala, Malala, do you hear me? She called. I grunted. Mariam tried to find out more what was going on. A doctor she knew told her the bullet had passed through my forehead, not my brain, and that I was safe. She also saw the two other Hushal girls who had been shot. Shazia had been shot twice, in the left collarbone and the palm, and had been brought to the hospital with me. Kenath had not realized she was hurt to start with and had gone home, then discovered she had been grazed by a bullet at the top of her right arm, so her family had brought her in. My father knew he should go and check on them, but did not want to leave my bedside for a minute. His phone kept ringing. The chief minister of KPK was the first person who called. "Don't worry, we will sort everything out," he said. "Lady Reading Hospital in Peshawar is expecting you." But it was the army who took charge. At 3 p.m., the local commander arrived and announced they were sending an army helicopter to take me and my father to Peshawar. There wasn't time to fetch my mother, so Miriam insisted she would go too, as I might need a woman's help. Miriam's family was not happy about this, as she was still nursing her baby boy who had recently undergone a small operation. But she is like my second mother. When I was put in the ambulance, my father was afraid the Taliban would attack again. It seemed to him that everyone must know who was inside. The helipad was only a mile away, a 5-minute drive, but he was scared the whole way. When we got there, the helicopter had not arrived, and we waited for what felt like hours to him inside the ambulance. Finally, it landed, and I was lifted on board by hospital staff with my father, my cousin Khanji, Ahmed Shah, and Miriam. None of them had ever been on a helicopter. As the helicopter took off, we flew over grassy ground where there was an army sports gala underway with patriotic music pounding from speakers. To hear them singing about love of country gave my father a bad taste. He normally liked singing along, but a patriotic song hardly seemed appropriate when here was a 15-year-old girl shot in the head, an almost dead daughter. Down below, my mother was watching from the roof of our house. When she heard that I'd been hurt, she was having her reading lesson with Miss Ulfat and struggling to learn words like book and apple. The news at first was muddled, and she initially believed I'd been in an accident and had hurt my foot. Then she rushed home and told my grandmother, who was staying with us at the time. She begged my grandmother to start praying immediately. We believe Allah listens more closely to the white-haired. Soon the house was full of women. In our culture, if someone dies, women come to the home of the deceased and the men to the hujra, not just family and close friends, but everyone from the neighborhood. My mother was astonished. She sat on a prayer mat and recited from the Quran. She told the ladies, "Don't cry, pray." Then my brothers rushed into the room. Atal, who had walked home from school, had turned on the television and seen the news that I had been shot. He had called Khushal, and together they joined the weeping. The phone did not stop ringing. People reassured my mother that although I had been shot in the head, the bullet had just skimmed my forehead. My mother was very confused by all the different stories. First that my foot had been injured, then that I had been shot in the head. She thought I would think it strange that she hadn't come to me, but people told her not to go as I was either dead or about to be moved. One of my father's friends phoned to tell her that I was being taken to Peshawar by helicopter and she should come by road. The worst moment for her was when someone came to the house with my front door keys that had been found at the scene of the shooting. "I don't want keys, I want my daughter," my mother cried. "What use are keys without Malala?" Then they heard the sound of the helicopter. The helipad was just a mile from our house, and all the women rushed up to the roof. "It must be Malala," they said. As they watched the helicopter fly overhead, my mother took her scarf off her head, an extremely rare gesture for a Pashtun woman, and lifted it up to the sky, holding it in both hands as if it was an offering. "God, I entrust her to you," she said to the heavens. "We didn't accept security guards. You are our protector. She was under your care, and you are bound to give her back." Inside the helicopter, I was vomiting blood. My father was horrified, thinking this meant I had internal bleeding. he was starting to lose hope. But then, Maryam noticed me trying to wipe my mouth with my scarf. "Look, she's responding," she said. "That's an excellent sign." When we landed in Peshawar, they assumed we'd be taken to Lady Reading Hospital, where there was a very good neurosurgeon called Dr. Mumtaz who had been recommended. Instead, they were alarmed to be taken to CMH, the Combined Military Hospital. CMH is a large sprawling brick hospital with 600 beds and dates from British rule. There was a lot of construction going on to build a new tower block. Peshawar is the gateway to the Fatah, and since the army went into those areas in 2004 to take on the militants, the hospital had been very busy tending wounded soldiers and victims of the frequent suicide bombs in and around the city. As in much of our country, there were concrete blocks and checkpoints all around CMH to protect it from suicide bombers. I was rushed to the intensive care unit, which is in a separate building. Above the nurse's station, the clock showed it was just after 5 p.m. I was wheeled into a glass-walled isolation unit, and a nurse put me on a drip. In the next room was a soldier who had been horrifically burned in an IED attack and had a leg blown off. A young man came and introduced himself as Colonel Junaid, the neurosurgeon. My father became even more disturbed. He didn't think he looked like a doctor. He seemed so young. "Is she your daughter?" asked the colonel. Maryam pretended to be my mother so she could come in. Colonel Junaid examined me. I was conscious and restless, but not speaking or aware of anything, my eyes fluttering. The colonel stitched the wound above my left brow where the bullet had entered, but he was surprised not to see any bullet in the scan. "If there is an entry, there has to be an exit," he said. He palpated my spine and located the bullet lying next to my left shoulder blade. "She must have been stooping, so her neck was bent when she was shot," he said. They took me for another CT scan. Then the colonel called my father into his office where he had the scans up on a screen. He told him that the scan and swath was done from only one angle, but his new scan showed the injury was more serious. "Look, Ziauddin," he said. "The CT scan shows the bullet went very close to the brain." He said particles of bone had damaged the brain membrane. "We can pray to God. Let's wait and see," he said. "We're not going to operate at this stage." My father became more agitated. In Swat, the doctors had told him this was something simple. Now it seemed very serious. And if it was serious, why weren't they operating? He felt uncomfortable in a military hospital. In our country, where the army has seized power so many times, people are often wary of the military, particularly those from Swat, where the army had taken so long to act against the Taliban. One of my father's friends called him and said, "Get her removed from this hospital. We don't want her to be made Shahid Milat, a martyr of the nation, like Liaquat Ali Khan." My father did not know what to do. "I'm confused," he told Colonel Junaid. "Why are we here? I thought we'd go to the civil hospital." Then he asked, "Please can you bring Dr. Mumtaz?" "How would that look?" replied Colonel Junaid, who was, not surprisingly, offended. Afterwards, we found out that despite his youthful appearance, he had been a neurosurgeon for 13 years and was the most experienced and decorated neurosurgeon in the Pakistani army. He had joined the military as a doctor because of their superior facilities, following in the footsteps of his uncle, who was also an army neurosurgeon. The Peshawar CMH was on the front line of the war on the Taliban, and Junaid dealt with gunshot wounds and blasts every day. "I've treated thousands of Malalas," he later said. But my father didn't know that at the time and became very depressed. "Do whatever you think," he said. "You are the doctor." The next few hours were a wait-and-see time, the nurses monitoring my heartbeat and vital signs. Occasionally, I made a low grunt and moved my hand or fluttered my eyes. Then Maryam would say, Malala, Malala, once my eyes completely opened. I never noticed before how beautiful her eyes are, said Miriam. I was restless and kept trying to get the monitor off my finger. Don't do that, Miriam said. Miss, don't tell me off, I whispered, as if we were at school. Madam Miriam was a strict headmistress. Late in the evening, my mother came with Atal. They had made the 4-hour journey by road, driven by my father's friend, Mohammed Farooq. Before she arrived, Mariam had called to warn her. When you see Malala, don't cry or shout. She can hear you, even if you think she can't. My father also called her and told her to prepare for the worst. He wanted to protect her. When she arrived, they hugged and held back tears. Here is Atal, she told me. He has come to see you. Atal was overwhelmed and cried a lot. Mama, he wept. Malala is hurt so badly. My mother was in a state of shock and could not understand why the doctors were not operating to remove the bullet. My brave daughter, my beautiful daughter, she cried. Atal was making so much noise that eventually an orderly took them to the hospital's military hostel where they were being put up. My father was bewildered by all the people gathered outside. Politicians, government dignitaries, provincial ministers who had come to show their sympathy. Even the governor was there, who gave my father 100,000 rupees for my treatment. In our society, if someone dies, you feel very honored if one dignitary comes to your home. But now he was irritated. He felt all these people were just waiting for me to die, when they had done nothing to protect me. Later, while they were eating, Atal turned on the TV. My father immediately turned it off. He couldn't face seeing news of my attack at that moment. When he left the room, Mariam switched it back on. Every channel appeared to be showing footage of me with a commentary of prayers and moving poems, as if I had died. My Malala, my mother started wailing, and Mariam joined her. Around midnight, Colonel Junaid asked to meet my father outside the ICU. Ziauddin, Malala's brain is swelling. My father didn't understand what this meant. The doctor told him I had started to deteriorate. My consciousness was fading, and I had again been vomiting blood. Colonel Junaid called for a third CT scan. This showed that my brain was swelling dangerously. But I thought the bullet hadn't entered her brain, said my father. Colonel Junaid explained that a bone had fractured and splinters had gone into my brain, creating a shock and causing it to swell. He needed to remove some of the skull to give my brain space to expand, otherwise the pressure would be unbearable. We need to operate now to give her a chance, he said. If we don't, she may die. I don't want you to look back and regret not taking action. Cutting away some of my skull sounded very drastic to my father. Will she survive? He asked desperately, but was given little reassurance at that stage. It was a brave decision by Colonel Junaid, whose own superiors were not convinced, and was also being told by other people that I should be sent abroad. It was a decision that would save my life. My father told him to go ahead, and Colonel Junaid said he would bring Dr. Mumtaz to help. My father's hand shook as he signed the consent papers. There in black and white were the words, "The patient may die." They started the operation around 1:30 a.m. My mother and father sat outside the operating theater. Oh God, please make Malala well, prayed my father. He began to make bargains with God. Even if I have to live in the deserts of the Sahara, I need her eyes open. I won't be able to live without her. Oh God, let me give the rest of my life to her. I have lived enough. Even if she is injured, just let her survive. Eventually, my mother interrupted him. God is not a miser, she said. He will give me back my daughter as she was. She began praying with the Holy Quran in her hand, just standing, facing the wall, praying, reciting verses over and over for hours. I had never seen someone praying like her, said Madame Maryam. I was sure God would answer such prayers. My father tried not to think about the past and whether he had been wrong to encourage me to speak out and campaign. Inside the theater, Colonel Janet used a saw to remove an 8 to 10 centimeter square of the upper left part of my skull, so my brain had the space to swell. He then cut into the subcutaneous tissue in the left of my stomach and placed the piece of bone in there to preserve it. Then he did a tracheotomy, as he was worried the swelling was blocking the airway. He also removed clots from my brain and the bullet from my shoulder blade. After all these procedures, I was put on a ventilator. The operation took almost 5 hours. Despite my mother's prayers, my father thought 90% of the people waiting outside were just waiting for the news of my death. Some of them, his friends and sympathizers, were very upset. But he felt that others were jealous of our high profile and believed we had got what was coming to us. My father was taking a short break from the intensity of the operating theater and was standing outside when a nurse approached him. Are you Malala's father? Once again, my father's heart sunk. The nurse took him into a room. He thought they were going to say, "We are sorry. I'm afraid we have lost her." But once inside, he was told, "We need someone to get blood from the blood bank." He was relieved, but baffled. "Am I the only person who can fetch it?" he wondered. One of his friends went instead. It was about 5:30 a.m. when the surgeons came out. Among other things, they told my father that they had removed a piece of skull and put it in my abdomen. In our culture, doctors don't explain things to patients or relatives, and my father asked humbly, "If you don't mind, I have a stupid question. Will she survive? What do you think?" "In medicine, 2 plus 2 does not always make 4, replied Colonel Junaid. "We did our job. We removed the piece of skull. Now we must wait." "I have another stupid question," said my father. "What about this bone? What will you do with it?" "After 3 months, we will put it back," replied Dr. Mumtaz. "It's very simple, just like this," he clapped his hands. The next morning, the news was good. I had moved my arms. Then 3 top surgeons from the province came to examine me. They said Colonel Junaid had done a splendid job and the operation had gone very well, but that I should now be put into induced coma because if I regained consciousness, there would be pressure on the brain. While I was hovering between life and death, the Taliban issued a statement assuming responsibility for shooting me, but denying it was because of my campaign for education. "We carried out this attack, and anybody who speaks against us will be attacked in the same way," said Isanullah Ehsan, a spokesman for the TTP. Malala had been targeted because of her pioneer role in preaching secularism. She was young, but she was promoting Western culture in Pashtun areas. She was pro-West. She was speaking against the Taliban. She was calling President Obama her idol. My father knew what he was referring to. After I won the National Peace Award the year before, I had done many TV interviews, and in one of them, I had been asked to name my favorite politicians. I had chosen Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, Benazir Bhutto, and President Barack Obama. I had read about Obama and admired him because as a young black man from a struggling family, he had achieved his ambitions and dreams. But the image of America and Pakistan had become one of drones, secret raids on our territory, and Raymond Davis. A Taliban spokesman said that Fazlullah had ordered the attack at a meeting 2 months earlier. "Anyone who sides with the government against us will die at our hands," he said. "You will see. Other important people will soon become victims." He added they had used two local Swati men who had collected information about me and my route to school, and had deliberately carried out the attack near an army checkpoint to show they could strike anywhere. That first morning, just a few hours after my operation, there was a sudden flurry of activity, people neatening their uniforms and clearing up. Then General Kayani swept in. "The nation's prayers are with you and your daughter," he told my father. I had met General Kayani when he came to Swat for a big meeting at the end of 2009, after the campaign against the Taliban. "I am happy you did a splendid job," I said at that meeting. "Now you just need to catch Fazlullah." The hall filled with applause, and General Kayani came and put his hand on my head like a father. Dr. Junaid gave the general a briefing of the surgery and the proposed treatment plan. General Kayani told him he should send the CT scans abroad to the best experts for advice. After his visit, no one else was allowed to my bedside because of the risk of infection, but many kept coming. Imran Khan, the cricketer-turned-politician, Mian Iftikhar Hussain, the provincial information minister, an outspoken critic of the Taliban, whose only son had been shot dead by them, and the chief minister of KPK, Haider Hoti, with whom I had appeared on talk show discussions. None of them were allowed in. "Rest assured, Malala will not die," Hoti told people. "She still has lots to do." Then around 3 p.m. in the afternoon, two British doctors arrived by helicopter from Rawalpindi. Dr. Javed Kayani and Dr. Fiona Reynolds were from hospitals in Birmingham and happened to be in Pakistan advising the army on how to set up the country's first liver transplant program. "Our country is full of shocking statistics, not just on education. And one of them is that 1 in 7 children in Pakistan get hepatitis, largely because of dirty needles, and many die of liver disease." General Kayani was determined to change this, and the army had once again stepped in where the civilians had failed to plan a transplant program. He had asked the doctors to brief him on their progress before flying home, which happened to be the morning after I had been shot. When they went in to see him, he had several televisions on, a local channel in Urdu and Sky News in English, with news of my shooting. The army chief and the doctor were not related despite sharing a surname, but knew each other well, so the general told Dr. Javed he was worried about the conflicting reports he was receiving and asked him to assess me before flying back to the UK. Dr. Javed, who is an emergency care consultant at Queen Elizabeth Hospital, agreed but asked to take Dr. Fiona, as she is from Birmingham Children's Hospital and a specialist in children's intensive care. Dr. Fiona was nervous about going to Peshawar, which has become a no-go area for foreigners. But when she heard that I was a campaigner for girls' education, she was happy to help, as she herself had been lucky to go to a school and train to become a doctor. Colonel Junaid and the hospital director were not pleased to see them. There was some discussion until Dr. Javed made it clear who had sent them. The British doctors were not happy with what they found. First, they turned on the tap to wash their hands and discovered there was no water. Then Dr. Fiona checked the machines and levels and muttered something to Dr. Kayani. She asked when my blood pressure had last been checked. 2 hours ago, came the reply. She said it needed to be checked all the time and asked the nurse why there was no arterial line. She also complained that my carbon dioxide level was far too low. My father was glad he didn't hear what she told Dr. Javed. She had said I was salvageable. I had had the right surgery at the right time, but my chances of recovery were now being compromised by the aftercare. After neurosurgery, it is essential to monitor breathing and gas exchange, and CO2 levels are supposed to be kept in the normal range. That's what all the tubes and machines were monitoring. Dr. Javed said it was like flying an aircraft. You can only do it using the right instruments, and even if the hospital had them, they weren't being used properly. Then they left in their helicopter because it is dangerous to be in Peshawar after dark. Among the visitors who came and were not allowed in was Rehman Malik, the interior minister. He had brought with him a passport for me. My father thanked him, but he was very upset. That night when he went back to the army hostel, he took the passport from his pocket and gave it to my mother. "This is Malala's, but I don't know whether it's to go abroad or to the heavens," he said. They both cried. In their bubble in the hospital, they did not realize that my story had traveled all around the world and that people were calling for me to be sent abroad for treatment. My condition was deteriorating, and my father now rarely picked up his calls. One of the few he took was from the parents of Arfa Karim, a child computer genius from Punjab, Pakistan, with whom I had spoken on forums. She had become the youngest Microsoft-certified professional at the age of 9 and had even been invited to meet Bill Gates in Silicon Valley. But tragically, she had died that January of a heart attack following an epileptic fit. She was just 16, 1 year older than me. When her father called mine, my father cried. "Tell me, how can one live without daughters?" he sobbed. 22. Journey into the Unknown. I was shot on a Tuesday at lunchtime. By Thursday morning, my father was so convinced that I would die that he told my uncle Faiz Muhammad that the village should start preparing for my funeral. I had been put into an induced coma. My vital signs were deteriorating. My face and body were swollen, and my kidneys and lungs failing. My father later told me that it was terrifying to see me connected to all the tubes in that small glass cubicle. As far as he could see, I was medically dead. He was devastated. My mother was still praying. She had barely slept. My uncle Faiz Muhammad had told her she should recite the Surat of the Hajj, the chapter of the Quran about pilgrimage, and she recited over and over again the same 12 verses, 58 to 70, about the all-powerfulness of God. She told my father she felt I would live, but he could not see how. When Colonel Junaid came to check on me, my father again asked him, "Will she survive?" "Do you believe in God?" the doctor asked him. "Yes," said my father. Colonel Junaid seemed to be a man of great spiritual depth. His advice was to appeal to God and that he would answer our prayers. Late on Wednesday night, two military doctors who were intensive care specialists had arrived by road from Islamabad. They had been sent by General Kayani after the British doctors had reported back to him that if I was left in Peshawar, I would suffer brain damage or might even die because of the quality of intensive care and the high risk of infection. They wanted to move me, but suggested that in the meantime, a top doctor be brought in. But it seemed they were too late. The hospital staff had made none of the changes Dr. Fiona had recommended, and my condition had deteriorated as the night went on. Infection had set in. On Thursday morning, one of the men, Brigadier Aslam, called Dr. Fiona. "Malala is now very sick," he told her. "I had developed something called disseminated intravascular coagulation, DIC, which meant my blood was not clotting. My blood pressure was very low, and my blood acid had risen. I wasn't passing urine anymore, so my kidneys were failing, and my lactate levels had risen. It seemed that everything that could go wrong had." Dr. Fiona was about to leave for the airport to fly back to Birmingham. Her bags were already at the airport, but when she heard the news, she offered to help and two nurses from our hospital in Birmingham stayed on with her. She arrived back in Peshawar Thursday lunchtime. She told my father that I was to be airlifted to an army hospital in Rawalpindi, which had the best intensive care. He couldn't see how a child so sick could fly. But Dr. Fiona assured him that she did this all the time, so not to worry. He asked her if there was any hope for me. "Had there been no hope, I would not be here," she replied. My father says that in that moment, he could not hold back his tears. Later that day, a nurse came and put drops in my eyes. Look, Ziauddin, said my mother. Dr. Fiona is right because nurses put eye drops in Malala's eyes. They wouldn't put drops in if there was no chance. One of the other girls who had been shot, Shazia, had been moved to the same hospital and Fiona went to check on her. She told my father that Shazia was fine and had begged her, look after Malala. We were taken to the helipad by ambulance under high security, with motorcycle outriders and flashing blue lights. The helicopter flight was 1 hour 15 minutes. Dr. Fiona hardly sat down. She was so busy the whole way with all the different equipment that it looked to my father as if she was fighting with it. She'd been doing what she'd been doing for years. Half her work in the UK was moving critically ill children. The other half was treating them in intensive care. But she had never been in a situation quite like this. Not only was Peshawar dangerous for Westerners, but after Googling me, she realized this was no ordinary case. If anything had happened to her, it would have been blamed on the white woman, she said afterwards. If she died, I would have killed Pakistan's Mother Teresa. As soon as we landed in Rawalpindi, we were taken by ambulance under a military escort to a hospital called the Armed Forces Institute of Cardiology. My father was alarmed. How would they know how to deal with head wounds? But Fiona assured him it had the best intensive care in Pakistan, with the state-of-the-art equipment and British-trained doctors. Her own nurses from Birmingham were there waiting and had explained to the cardiology nurses the specific procedures for dealing with head injuries. They spent the next 3 hours with me, swapping my antibiotics and my bloodlines as I seemed to be reacting badly to the blood transfusions. Finally, they said I was stable. The hospital had been put on complete lockdown. There was an entire battalion of soldiers guarding it and even snipers on the rooftops. No one was allowed in. Doctors had to wear uniforms. Patients could only be visited by close relatives, all of whom underwent strict security checks. An army major was assigned to my parents and followed them everywhere. My father was scared. My uncle kept saying, "Be very careful. Some of these people might be secret agents." My family was given 3 rooms in the officers' hostel. Everyone's mobile phones were confiscated, which they said was for security reasons, but may have also been to stop my father talking to the media. Anytime my parents wanted to take the short walk from the hostel to the hospital, they first had to clear the way with walkie-talkies, which took at least 30 minutes. They were even guarded as they crossed the hostel lawn to the dining hall. No visitors could get in. Even when the Prime Minister came to see me, he was not allowed inside. The security seemed astonishing. But over the last 3 years, the Taliban had managed to infiltrate and attack even the most highly guarded military installations. The naval base at Mehran, the Air Force base in Kamra, and the GHQ just down the road. We were all at risk from Taliban attack. My father was told that even my brothers would not be spared. He was very concerned because at that time, Khushal was still in Mingora, although later he was brought down to Rawalpindi to join them. There were no computers or internet in the hostel, but the friendly cook, Yaseem Mama, used to bring my family the newspapers and whatever they needed. Yaseem told them he felt proud to prepare my family's food. They were so touched by his kindness that they shared our story with him. He wanted to nourish them with food and ease their suffering. They had no appetite, so he would try to tempt them with ever more delicious dishes, custards and sweets. One mealtime, Khushal said the dining table felt empty with only the 4 of them. They felt incomplete without me. It was in one of Yaseem's newspapers that my father read for the first time some of the incredible international reaction to my shooting. It seemed like the whole world was outraged. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, called it a heinous and cowardly act. President Obama had described the shooting as reprehensible and disgusting and tragic. But some of the reaction in Pakistan was not so positive. While some papers described me as a peace icon, others carried the usual conspiracy theories. Some bloggers even questioning if I had really been shot. All sorts of stories were made up, particularly in the Urdu press, such as one that claimed I had criticized the growing of beards. One of the most vocal people against me was a female MP called Dr. Rahila Qazi from the religious party Jamaat Islami. She called me an American stooge and showed the photograph of me sitting next to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke as evidence of me hobnobbing with US military authority. Dr. Fiona was a great comfort to us. My mother speaks only Pashto, so couldn't understand anything she said. But Fiona would gesture with a thumbs up when she came out of my room and say, "Good." She became a messenger for my parents, not only a doctor. She would sit with them patiently and then ask my father to explain every detail to my mother. My father was astonished and pleased. In our country, few doctors would bother explaining anything to an illiterate woman. They heard that offers were pouring in from overseas to treat me, including from America, where a top hospital called Johns Hopkins had offered free treatment. Individual Americans also offered to help, including Senator John Kerry, a rich man who had visited Pakistan many times, and Gabrielle Giffords, a congresswoman who had been shot in the head while meeting constituents at a shopping mall in Arizona. There were offers too from Germany, Singapore, the UAE, and Britain. Nobody consulted my mother and father on what should happen to me. All decisions were made by the army. General Kayani asked Dr. Javed whether I should be sent abroad or not. The army chief was spending a surprising amount of his time on the issue. Dr. Javed says they spent 6 hours discussing me, perhaps more than any politician. He understood the political implications if I did not survive. He was hoping to build a political consensus behind launching an all-out attack on the Taliban. But also, those close to him say he is a compassionate man. His own father was just an ordinary soldier and died young, leaving him as the eldest son of 8 to support his entire family. When he became army chief, the first thing General Kayani did was improve housing, food rations, and education for ordinary soldiers instead of officers. Dr. Fiona said it was likely I would have a speech impediment and a weak right arm and right leg, so I would need extensive rehabilitation facilities, which Pakistan didn't have. If you're serious about getting the best outcome possible, take her overseas, she advised. General Kayani was adamant that the Americans should not be involved because of the ongoing bad relations between the two countries after the Raymond Davis episode and the Bin Laden raid, as well as the killings of some Pakistani soldiers at a border post by a US helicopter. Dr. Javed suggested Great Ormond Street in London and specialist hospitals in Edinburgh and Glasgow. Why not your own hospital? General Kayani asked. Dr. Javed had known this was coming. Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham is known for treating British soldiers wounded in Afghanistan and Iraq. Its location outside the center of the city also offered privacy. He called his boss, Kevin Bolger, the hospital's chief operating officer. He quickly agreed it was the right thing to do, although afterwards he said none of us ever imagined how much it would take over the entire hospital. Moving me, a foreign minor, to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital was not a simple exercise, and Bolger soon found himself tangled in the hoops of British and Pakistani bureaucracy. Meanwhile, time was ticking away. Although my condition had been stabilized, it was felt that I needed to be moved within 48 hours, or 72 hours at the most. Finally, we were given the go-ahead, and now we had to face the problem of how I was to be moved and who would pay for it. Dr. Javed suggested taking up an offer from the Royal Air Force in UK, as they were used to transporting wounded soldiers from Afghanistan. But General Kiani refused. He called Dr. Javed for a late-night meeting at his house. The general keeps late hours and explained, chain-smoking as usual, that he did not want any foreign military involved. There were already too many conspiracy theories floating around about my shooting, people saying I was a CIA agent and such things, and the army chief did not want to further fuel them. This left Dr. Javed in a difficult position. The British government had offered assistance but needed a formal request from the Pakistan government. But my government was reluctant to ask for fear of loss of face. Fortunately, at this point, the ruling family of the United Arab Emirates stepped in. They offered their private jet, which had its own onboard hospital. I was to be flown out of Pakistan for the first time in my life in the early hours of Monday, October 15th. My parents had no idea of any of these negotiations, though they knew discussions were underway to move me overseas. Naturally, they assumed that wherever I was sent, they would accompany me. My mother and brothers had no passports or documentation. On Sunday afternoon, my father was informed by the colonel that I would be leaving the next morning for the UK, and only he was to accompany me, not my mother or my brothers. He was told there was a problem arranging their passports, and that for security reasons, he should not even tell the rest of my family he was going. My father shares everything with my mother, and there was no way he would keep such a thing a secret. He told her the news with a heavy heart. My mother was sitting with Uncle Faiz Muhammad, who was furious and worried about her and my brother's security. If she's on her own with two boys in Mingora, anything could happen to them. My father called the colonel. I have informed my family and they are very unhappy. I cannot leave them. This caused a big problem, because I was a minor so couldn't be sent alone, and many people got involved to try and convince my father to come with me, including Colonel Junaid, Dr. Javed and Dr. Fiona. My father does not respond well to being pushed, and remained firm even though it was clear that by now he was creating havoc. My father explained to Dr. Javed, "My daughter is now in safe hands and going to a safe country. I can't leave my wife and sons alone here. They are at risk. What has happened to my daughter has happened, and now she is in God's hands. I am a father. My sons are as important to me as my daughter." Dr. Javed asked to see my father privately. "Are you sure this is the only reason you're not coming?" he asked. He wanted to make sure no one was pressuring him. "My wife told me, 'You can't leave us,'" my father said. The doctor put a hand on his shoulder and reassured my father that I would be taken care of and to trust him. "Isn't it a miracle you all happened to be here when Malala was shot?" said my father. "It is my belief God sends the solution first and the problem later," replied Dr. Javed. My father then signed a loco parentis certificate, making Dr. Fiona my guardian for the trip to the UK. My father was in tears as he gave her my passport and took the doctor's hand. "Fiona, I trust you. Please take care of my daughter." Then my mother and father came to my bedside to say goodbye. It was around 11 p.m. when they saw me for the last time in Pakistan. I could not speak. My eyes were shut, and it was only my breath that reassured them I was still alive. My mother cried, but my father tried to reassure her as he felt I was now out of danger. All those deadlines they'd given at the beginning, when they said the next 24 hours are dangerous, 48 are crucial, 72 is critical, had all passed without incident. The swelling had gone down and my blood levels had improved. My family trusted that Dr. Fiona and Dr. Javed would give me the best possible care. When my family went back to their rooms, sleep was slow in coming. Just after midnight, someone knocked at their door. It was one of those colonels who had earlier tried to convince my father to leave my mother behind and travel to the UK. He told my father that he absolutely had to travel with me, or I might not be taken at all. I told you last night the issue was resolved, my father replied. Why did you wake me? I'm not leaving my family. And once again, another official was called to talk to him. You must go. You are her parent, and if you don't accompany her, she may not be accepted to the hospital in UK, he said. What's done is done, my father insisted. I'm not changing my mind. We will all follow in a few days when the documents are sorted out. The colonel then said, Let's go to the hospital as there are other documents to sign. My father became suspicious. It was after midnight and he was scared. He didn't want to go alone with the officials and insisted my mother come too. My father was so worried that for the whole time he repeated a verse of the Holy Quran over and over. This verse was recited by the Prophet Yunus when he was in the tummy of the whale. O God, I'm in the belly of the whale, my father prayed. The verse reassures us that there is a way out of trouble and danger if we keep faith. When they got to the hospital, the colonel told my father that if I was to be allowed to fly to the UK, then there were other documents that needed to be signed. It was simple. My father had felt so uncomfortable and scared because of the secrecy of all the arrangements, the men in uniforms everywhere, and the vulnerability of our family that he had panicked and blown the incident out of proportion. The whole episode had been a matter of botched bureaucracy. When my parents finally got back to the hostel, it was with a very heavy heart. My father did not want me to come round in a strange country without my family there. He worried about how confused I would be. My last memory would be of the school bus, and he was distraught that I would feel abandoned by them. I was taken away at 5 a.m. on Monday, 15th October, under armed escort. The roads to the airport had been closed, and there were snipers on the rooftops of the buildings lining the route. The Royal UAE plane was waiting. I am told it was the height of luxury with a plush double bed, 16 first-class seats and a mini hospital at the back staffed with European nurses led by a German doctor. I am just sorry I wasn't conscious to enjoy it. The plane flew to Abu Dhabi for refueling, then headed on to Birmingham, where it landed in the late afternoon. In the hostel, my parents waited. They assumed their passports and visas were being processed and they would join me within a few days. But they heard nothing. They had no phones and no access to a computer to check on my progress. The wait felt endless. Part 5. A Second Life. I am a patriot and I love my country, and for that I would gladly sacrifice all. 23. The Girl Shot in the Head, Birmingham. I woke up on 16th October, a week after the shooting. I was thousands of miles away from home, with a tube in my neck to help me breathe, and unable to speak. I was on the way back to critical care after another CT scan, and flitted between consciousness and sleep until I woke properly. The first thing I thought when I came round was, thank God I'm not dead. But I had no idea where I was. I knew I was not in my homeland. The nurses and doctors were speaking English, though they seemed to all be from different countries. I was speaking to them, but no one could hear me because of the tube in my neck. To start with, my left eye was very blurry, and everyone had two noses and four eyes. All sorts of questions flew through my waking brain. Where was I? Who had brought me here? Where were my parents? Was my father alive? I was terrified. Dr. Javed, who was there when I was brought round, says he will never forget the look of fear and bewilderment on my face. He spoke to me in Urdu. The only thing I knew was that Allah had blessed me with a new life. A nice lady in a headscarf held my hand and said, Assalamu alaikum, which is our traditional Muslim greeting. Then she started saying prayers in Urdu and reciting verses of the Quran. She told me her name was Rahana and she was the Muslim chaplain. Her voice was soft and her words were soothing, and I drifted back to sleep. I dreamt I wasn't really in hospital. When I woke again the next day, I noticed I was in a strange green room with no windows and very bright lights. It was an intensive care cubicle in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. Everything was clean and shiny, not like the hospital in Mingora. A nurse gave me a pencil and a pad. I couldn't write properly. The words came out wrong. I wanted to write my father's phone number. I couldn't space letters. Dr. Javed brought me an alphabet board so I could point to the letters. The first words I spelled out were father and country. The nurse told me I was in Birmingham, but I had no idea where that was. Only later did they bring me an atlas so I could see it was in England. I didn't know what had happened. The nurses weren't telling me anything, even my name. Was I still Malala? My head was aching so much that even the injections they gave me couldn't stop the pain. My left ear kept bleeding and my left hand felt funny. Nurses and doctors kept coming in and out. The nurses asked me questions and told me to blink twice for yes. No one told me what was going on or who had brought me to the hospital. I thought they didn't know themselves. I could feel that the left side of my face wasn't working properly. If I looked at the nurses or doctors for too long, my left eye watered. I didn't seem to be able to hear from my left ear, and my jaw wouldn't move properly. I gestured to people to stand on my right. Then a kind lady called Dr. Fiona came and gave me a white teddy bear. She said I should call it Junaid, and she would explain why later. I didn't know who Junaid was, so I named it Lily. She also brought me a pink exercise book to write in. The first two questions my pen wrote were, "Why have I no father?" and "My father has no money. Who will pay for all this?" "Your father is safe," she replied. "He is in Pakistan. Don't worry about payment." I repeated the questions to anyone who came in. They all said the same, but I was not convinced. I had no idea what had happened to me, and I didn't trust anyone. If my father was fine, why wasn't he here? I thought my parents didn't know where I was, and could be searching for me in the chowks and bazaars of Mingora. I didn't believe my parents were safe. Those first days, my mind kept drifting in and out of a dream world. I kept having flashbacks to lying on a bed with men around me, so many that you couldn't count, and asking, "Where is my father?" I thought I had been shot, but wasn't sure. Were these dreams or memories? I was also obsessed by money. The money from the awards had almost all gone on the school and buying a plot of land in our village in Shangla. I saw the doctors talking to one another and I thought they were saying, "Malala doesn't have any money. Malala can't pay for her treatment." One of the doctors was a Polish man who always looked sad. I thought he was the owner of the hospital and was unhappy because I couldn't pay. So I gestured at a nurse for paper and wrote, "Why are you sad?" He replied, "No, I am not sad." "Who will pay?" I wrote. "We don't have any money." "Don't worry, your government will pay," he said. Afterwards, he always smiled when he saw me. I always think about solutions to problems. So I thought maybe I could go down to the reception of the hospital and ask for a phone to call my mother and father. But my brain was telling me, "You don't have the money to pay for the call, nor do you know the country code." Then I thought, I need to go out and start working to earn money so I can buy a phone and call my father so we can all be together again. Everything was so mixed up in my mind. I thought the teddy bear Dr. Fiona had given me was green and had been swapped with a white one. "Where's the green teddy?" I kept asking, even though I was told over and over there was no green teddy. The green was probably the glow of the walls in the intensive care unit, but I'm still convinced there was a green teddy. I kept forgetting English words. One note to the nurses was a wire to clean my teeth. It felt like something was stuck between them, and I meant floss. Actually, my tongue was numb, and my teeth were fine. The only thing that calmed me was when Rahana came. She said healing prayers, and I started moving my lips to some of them and mouthing Amin, our word for Amen, at the end. The television was kept off, except once when they let me watch MasterChef, which I used to watch in Mingora and loved, but everything was blurred. It was only later I learned that people were not allowed to bring in newspapers or tell me anything, as the doctors were worried it could traumatize me. I was worried my father could be dead. Then Fiona brought in a Pakistani newspaper from the week before, which had a photograph of my father talking to General Kayani with a shawled figure sitting at the back next to my brother. I could just see her feet. "That's my mother," I wrote. Later that day, Dr. Javed came in with his mobile phone. "We're going to call your parents," he said. My eyes shone with excitement. "You won't cry, you won't weep," he instructed me. He was gruff but very kind, like he had known me forever. "I will give you the mobile and be strong." I nodded. He dialed the number, spoke, and then gave me the phone. There was my father's voice. I couldn't talk because of the tube in my neck, but I was so happy to hear him. I couldn't smile because of my face, but it was as if there was a smile inside. "I'll come soon," he promised. "Now have a rest, and in 2 days we will be there." Later, he told me that Dr. Javed had also ordered him not to cry, as that would make us all sadder. The doctor wanted us to be strong for each other. The call did not last long because my parents did not want to tire me out. My mother blessed me with prayers. I still presumed that the reason they weren't with me was because my father didn't have the money to pay for my treatment. That's why he was still in Pakistan, to sell our land in the village and also our school. But our land was small, and I knew our school buildings and our house were rented, so what could he sell? Perhaps he was asking rich people for a loan. Even after the call, my parents were not completely reassured. They hadn't actually heard my voice and were still cut off from the outside world. People who visited them were bringing conflicting reports. One of those visitors was Major General Ghulam Kamal, head of military operations in Swat. "There is good news coming from the UK," he told my father. "We are very happy our daughter has survived." He said "our," because now I was seen as the daughter of the nation. The general told my father that they were carrying out door-to-door searches throughout Swat and monitoring the borders. He said they knew that the people who had targeted me came from a gang of 22 Taliban men and that they were the same gang who had attacked Zahid Khan, my father's friend, who had been shot 2 months earlier. My father said nothing, but he was outraged. The army had been saying for ages that there were no Taliban in Mingora, and that they had cleared them all out. Now, this general was telling him that there had been 22 of them in our town for at least 2 months. The army had also insisted Zahid Khan was shot in a family feud and not by the Taliban. Now they were saying I had been targeted by the same Taliban as him. My father wanted to say, "You knew there were Taliban in the valley for 2 months. You knew they wanted to kill my daughter and you didn't stop them?" But he realized it would get him nowhere. The general hadn't finished. He told my father that although it was good news that I had regained consciousness, there was a problem with my eyesight. My father was confused. How could the officer have information he didn't? He was worried that I would be blind. He imagined his beloved daughter, her face shining, walking around in lifelong darkness asking, "Abba, where am I?" So awful was this news that he couldn't tell my mother, even though he is usually hopeless at keeping secrets, particularly from her. Instead, he told God, "This is unacceptable. I will give her one of my own eyes." But then he was worried that at 43 years old, his own eyes might not be very good. He hardly slept that night. The next morning, he asked the major in charge of security if he could borrow his phone to call Colonel Junaid. "I've heard that Malala can't see," my father told him in distress. "That's nonsense," he replied. "If she can read and write, how can she not see? Dr. Fiona has kept me updated, and one of the first notes Malala wrote was to ask about you." Far away in Birmingham, not only could I see, but I was asking for a mirror. "Mirror," I wrote in the pink diary. I wanted to see my face and hair. The nurses brought me a small white mirror, which I still have. When I saw myself, I was distraught. My long hair, which I used to spend ages styling, had gone, and the left side of my head had none at all. "Now my hair is small," I wrote in the book. I thought the Taliban had cut it off. In fact, the Pakistani doctors had shaved my head with no mercy.